Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. Then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk.
Good evening and welcome to Yada Radio. It was my pleasure to be with you. Kirk, it's good to have you here. I sent you a text just on a lighter note asking if you were watching the play-by-play here and the stroke-by-stroke, if you will, in the Players' Championship. I have long been a golfer. I know you're a better golfer than I, but it is one of the great escapes from the aches and pains of life. It's one of these great opportunities to take a walk in nature with a good friend and have a lovely conversation. Yeah. And I was noting in a text that I sent you midweek is that I'd always thought that Augusta would be the most interesting golf course to play. And previously, I would say Old Head, maybe in Ireland, and Pebble Beach were my favorite golf courses. But I've been watching this because they're now, we have so many wonderful cameras. They actually will take you throughout an entire round from the perspective of every group. So you can pick your favorite group, and you can follow them, hit every shot from the perspective of that shot with overviews of the hole, and then the perspective and the sight lines of Sawgrass. What Pete Dye and his wife did with that course is just magnificent. Mm-hmm. Amazing that we can craft something that beautiful. I told you, I think there's only one uninspired hole in the whole course, the 18th.
Yeah.
The 18th is just boring.
Everybody,
just get
a lot
out
of
to
people
me.
Have that kind of course, yeah. A lot of them use that kind of thing where it is so deadly, but it could be better looking.
Oh, the 18th is just ugly as sin. I mean, it just has this huge amount of water and at no interesting shoreline, no interest to the right, no interest in terms of the pond on the left. But it could be remade so that it was as interesting as the others. But every other hole, it's just spectacular. Those old trees with the Spanish moss and the way the waterways weave in and out and the contours of those fairways and the sight lines from the tee and then the sight lines into your approach shot to those greens. What a beautiful anyway, no one tuned in this evening to hear us wax poetic about golf, but maybe it helps to know that we actually do have a life apart from this. I received an email from a conspiracy hack this week that likes to send me conspiracy emails from time to time. I think this person was a holdover from the idiot that was the conspiracy nut from long ago. And so he sends me this thing that is that if you don't have the vaccine in Israel, your life is over. This way that the article reads. And this article goes on to say it is possible that those with the Hunan virus, this is COVID-19, are are reprogramming, vaccines are reprogramming recipients in such a way that later down the road, they will no longer have the willpower or understand to reject the full mark of the beast, making their acceptance inevitable. I mean, how in the world could you have 1 ounce of mental capacity and think that a vaccine that produces antibodies so that you won't contract a rather debilitating virus is about to reprogram your willpower, and that this is somehow associated with the mark of the beast? First of all, there is no mark of the beast. Okay? There just is no mark of the beast. The Christian New Testament is absolutely rubbish from beginning to end. And your fascination with the mark of the beast is just stupid. If you want to know who the beast is, it's Christianity. Look in the damn mirror and you'll see the beast. I mean, Paul, crying out loud, was the father of lies, the son of evil, and the plague of death, according to God. But good grief. Your life is not over in Israel if you don't get the vaccine. It's just that you lose privileges. If you're stupid enough to say you don't want the vaccine because you think you're being reprogrammed or that you're taking the mark,
stay away with
it. If you are that stupid, then you have forfeited the right to be in close proximity with other people. We don't want
Fair
to
enough.
Catch it. You have all the right in the world to get COVID yourself. And if you're one of these nuts, I hope you do. But you do not have the right to infect others.
Hear, hear.
I mean, good grief. Now, I've had the vaccine. I've had both of my jabs. Non-event.
One of the things you
find out is that Israel is doing the best job of providing data on the vaccine. It made me feel so much better. Well, part of it was that, a messenger RNA vaccine is something brand new. We've never programmed our RNA to deliver messages such that it would create antibodies. So this was something very new. And so I had some anxiety. I think I even shared it on this program. I had a long conversation with my youngest son, who has a PhD in medicinal chemistry, explained how the programming works. It doesn't alter your DNA in any way. It doesn't even alter your RNA, but it puts a program code on your RNA to write the message to produce the proper antibodies so that you're not going to contract, or if you were to contract, it will not, the COVID-19 virus is not going to take hold and multiply in your body. And what I was able to do then is, after Israel gave, five million of these vaccines, 4 million people twice, is that Israel has published all the data. And the data is basically that the likelihood of you having a negative effect from the vaccine is about 1 in 100,000. 1 in 100,000. The likelihood of you becoming hospitalized with COVID after having the vaccine is exceedingly rare. And the number of people that have had a negative side effect just from the vaccine is lower than even 1 in 100,000. And I want to tell you that your likelihood of getting COVID and having a negative long-term reaction to it is in the 5 to 10% range. And the vaccine, 1 in 100,000. It's just stunningly effective. It's performing much better than the trials indicate that it would. So it is a intelligent thing to do. Science sometimes comes through with some extraordinary things. We should be grateful for it. Now, doesn't change my assessment of COVID all the way along. Never denied the virus. The virus came out of Wuhan, China. It was a combination of a of a lab accident and some really stupid things going on in China. And China did everything they could to cover it up, and they're responsible for a large part to the number of deaths worldwide. My issue with COVID-19 has always been the same, which is that when politicians, being completely ignorant of business,
economics,
and despising liberty, shut down people's opportunity to earn a livelihood and deprive them of their personal freedom, I said from the beginning that it will have no demonstrable effect on reducing the number of COVID infections and death, and that it will be wholly counterproductive, that the number of people who will die and the consequences, the negative consequences of doing those two things, both economically and with people's lives, whether it be alcoholism, drug abuse, domestic violence, or severe psychological reactions, will be vastly worse than just the disease itself. Those statements are all true. So I realize that government has responded very poorly and they changed the world forever. Mm-hmm. I am actually pleased that they did it, Kirk. And yes. The reason is that the world as we know it, sometime around 2029, we're going to move to a point where the world as we know it will cease to exist and man will begin his final death spiral in the last 3 to 4 years of our existence on this planet. And to tell people that what is coming and how soon it's coming, it's hard to believe that the world could change that radically in this short a period of time. Well, the day before and the day after the lockdowns on COVID and the utter destruction of our economy and total control, not only in the United States, but worldwide of people's lives, tells you that one day to the next can be radically different. We're never going back to the world of freedom and economic opportunity in the United States or anywhere in the world that existed pre-COVID. And the fact that it changed this quickly ought to open people's minds up to just how radical things can change in the next 10 years. The other thing that I wanted to share is that what we did to the economy is irrecoverable. And Biden and his administration have been absolutely out of control, stupid. They've exacerbated every potential negative thing that they could do. And so when we collapse, I can't tell you if that's going to be in 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, or 8 years, but when the U.S. economy collapses, it's going to take the world down with it, and there'll be nothing left. I mean, they will essentially render dollars useless. They'll allow you to exchange them into their new currency. Their new currency will be totally electronic. You'll be totally controlled. And the lure to get you to accept it will be the forgiveness of death and the fact that you'll actually be able to buy food. And you won't be able to otherwise. So the world is changing radically. There is a news, after I know I've said all this about COVID-19, there's an article that says that a couple of countries, Denmark and Norway, for example, I think one Asian country, actually stopped giving the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is the one that came out of, I think, the UK. And the reason they stopped giving it is that they had 30 people worldwide have gotten blood clots. And, you know, blood clots can be potentially fatal. They can cause stroke and the like. And so 30 people have gotten blood clots. That's about 6 people per million vaccines. And there's no correlation between the blood clots and the vaccine. So you're going to stop giving vaccines because 30 people out of, I don't know, 6 or 7 million have had blood clots. But nonetheless, that's the way we roll. Did you see the award that came out today for the family of George Floyd?
No.
$27 million wrongful death settlement.
You're kidding.
So here's a guy. He's an ex-felon. He went into a woman's home with a gun and was pregnant and pistol whipped her while robbing her. He has been in and out of jail his whole life as a cocaine addict and all of the things that people do that to support a cocaine habit. He was had become exceedingly abusive of fentanyl, was on fentanyl, in fact, the day of his arrest, which is probably the killer. The man did everything you could possibly do wrong. His death is his responsibility, the way he lived his life. Do I think that the cop should have put his knee on his neck for 8 minutes? Hell no. Cop had a really bad day. And the bad day caused a slightly premature death of a really awful human being in George Floyd. And to award him based upon that man's life and the fact that he resisted arrest, the fact that he was on fentanyl, the fact that he had COVID at the time, the fact that he was driving under the influence, the fact that he was passing a counterfeit bill, the fact that he stole that day, and all of the things that go along with it in his criminal record, and you're going to award that family $27 million, the people who made that decision ought to pay that $27 million out of their own pockets. I tell you, it's what in the world is coming to. Now, I don't know if you know this too, but a reporter yesterday wanted to report on the area where George Floyd was killed. And so he went to that with a microphone and a camera crew and started walking to the spot. Well, he was stopped, and somebody with some really nasty tone and words. I mean, every word was a pejorative swear word. Yeah, cuss word. Yeah. Told him that, you know, you're taking your life in your own hands. You crossed this barrier, and you're a dead man. This is an autonomous zone that you, being a white person, do not belong. Go away. He says, hey, I'm a reporter. Doesn't matter. You didn't hear what I said. You crossed that border. You're essentially a dead man. You don't belong here. So the slum now surrounding the George Floyd death site is a police-free zone, reporters-free zone, and, of course, the people who are complaining about racism are telling whites that they don't belong. They have to go away. Welcome to the crazy world that we live in. Speaking of crazies, I am sure you know there was Muslims acted badly in Brussels, and there was a suicide bombing, and a bunch of people were killed. So the Muslims, Ibrahim El Barakoui, blew himself up at the airport in 2016. He murdered 11 people, and his brother Khalid left another 20 dead at a metro station. Why? Because they're Muslims. It's interesting, though, the surviving brother said, giggles, just to see what it was like to kill somebody, that they shot dead. They wanted to have a practice round to see what it was like to kill somebody. So they shot dead this 76-year-old man that was just walking down the street, killed him at random. He said that was their trial, so they could see what it was like to kill somebody. Isn't it wonderful what Islam does?
Well, you know, the passage we're about to get to in Genesis, Bereshit 4, there was a word in there when she describes, when Shawa describes her son, and he's with the word Nepal. And, of course, when J.B. did that response to Enoch, the book of Enoch, a while back, I remember going through all those words, and that's the verbal form of Nephilim, or it certainly is associated with the word Nephilim, with the base.
Yeah, I've been working on Nephilim all day today.
Yeah, well, that's the description. I mean, that really describes what they became before, that ushered in Noah's rescue. Because the world was just so horrible, and my God, we are there.
It's hard to miss Islam and Nephilim. because it's those who bow down, prostrate themselves, and decrease their status through battle and prayer. And so it's pretty hard not to see Islam as the poster child for Nephilim. But, you know, the United States is a real close second in the way that we enter
intermixed
religion and our military. Did you see that Bahrain, it was announced yesterday that the Bahraini security forces, another wonderful Islamic country, when in 2011 they had that pro-democracy uprising. So what they did, the security forces, to quell it, they took children away from their parents and they raped them, and then they subjected them to electric shocks.
Wow. My God.
There's a government. Yeah, I would. Why not have a, maybe we need to have a Formula One race there, maybe a tennis tournament, a golf tournament. Let's go reward those people. Let's go there, Europeans, on your holidays. Let's go sell them more jet airplanes so they can continue to do this kind of thing. There was a Republican, his name is Representative Ryan Mast, on Thursday. That would have been yesterday. He introduced legislation. And the legislation, this shows you how ignorant people are on both sides of the aisle. His legislation was to permanently withhold payments from the U.S. and other countries on debts owed to China. So, I don't know, China has $3.5 billion worth of T-bills. Maybe it's more than that. Maybe it's...
Well, whatever.
It can't be too... It really can't be... maybe I've did the dark ages here, but can't be that little, because $1 billion in terms of U.S. debt isn't even a sneeze, because we now have $30 trillion in debt. So maybe the number isn't, excuse me, it might be $3 trillion, not $3 billion. Probably is $3 trillion, 10% of our debt.
Probably is.
So what is the common denominator of bankrupt companies in terms of their debt? What would you say if you took all bankrupt companies and you said, okay, there is a common denominator relative to their loans and their payments of their debts that is universal among bankrupt entities? They welch on them.
That's the common denominator.
So what would happen to the U.S. credit rating? What would happen to the interest rates that the U.S. would have to pay to get people to borrow money if we decided that we don't want to pay off our debts anymore? Too damn bad.
Yeah. And system collapses. Yeah.
We would go from the perception of solvent to the realization we are insolvent in a heartbeat. I mean, here's a country that is living $30 trillion beyond its means, and you want to stop paying your debt? Yeah, it would. The consequence of that would bankrupt America in a heartbeat.
Of the world.
Right.
Do
the Chinese deserve to be held accountable for what they did in COVID? Absolutely. Damn right. And there's lots of intelligent ways to go about that. But deal with the debt instrument. If you're not going to pay it, you can't collapse your own economy.
No.
There's a Democratic senator now that is saying that the first thing they want to do now that they've gotten Biden's agenda out of the way. By the way, you probably noticed that Biden's been president now for over 50 days.
Yes.
What did you think of his last press conference?
Well, I didn't really stomach much of it. I kind of turned it off.
Wasn't really didn't stomach, is it? Is he didn't have one.
Yeah.
He hasn't had a press conference yet. And there's only one explanation as to why a newly elected president, over 50 days in office, hasn't had a press conference.
You can't talk in public.
Yeah, it's the same reason that during this entire election process, prior to the vote, that he was sequestered, that his team did everything possible to keep him out of the press.
Yeah.
He's senile. And that's really scary. And it's not so scary that the United States has a president of the United States that is senile. His vice president's worse than he is. But anyway, what they said is that their most recent bill, which was that their COVID relief bill, was the communist celebration bill. Everything that a liberal would want to crush the economy was included in that bill. But the senator says, you know, as part of that bill, one of the things we did is we lowered taxes on the lowest income Americans. So we want to now raise corporate taxes on corporations, and I don't care if CEOs whine. Hey, idiot! You know, it's been since before the Bush administration that the lowest paying Americans have paid any taxes. You know, 50% of Americans pay no taxes. How could you lower the taxes on people that pay no taxes? As a matter of fact, the lowest earning Americans receive a tax credit.
Yeah.
It's called the reverse income tax credit because people were complaining about welfare. So they did away with welfare, and they just relabeled it now the reverse income tax credit. What an absolute moron. And you want to make certain that there's no economic recovery? Take corporate taxes back up where they're among the highest in the world. Let's continue to
like in the days of Shirley,
success
like days
and reward failure. Yeah. It's just perfect. It's the democratic way. Now, that's our news for today.
Well,
I'll say
one little thing.
Is
we had this conversation like 8 years ago.
Yeah.
On the air, and the point was that, you know, if you put every time, if they go up another trillion or another couple of trillion, then the interest rates, you can't, what do you do with the interest rates? And if the interest rates go up, they have to pay it, that, and it's twofold effect. Number one, they can't, nobody else can borrow money if the interest rates go up. And
if we had to put interest on our T-bills sufficient to actually elicit those bills from countries and investors, as opposed to pretending that we're funding those bills through quantitative easing, creating the illusion of capital, which is just devaluing our existing currency. But if we're actually doing it the way that it used to be done, we actually had an auction and you go off and borrow money, and that was the majority of it, then our interest rates would probably be in the range of 10%. So annually, what is 10% interest on $30 trillion?
It's another $3 trillion every time you turn around.
We only, you know, the all the taxes bring in
don't come up to that
about $3 trillion, and the government costs about $4 to $5 trillion to run. So that means that every year, rather than adding another trillion or $2 trillion to the national debt, you're adding another $5 trillion to the national debt, and that $5 trillion has another $500 billion in just added cost of the borrowing. That's why you finally reach a point.
That's economics 101. What is it nobody sees in that? And I had this conversation about a week or so ago with someone. I'm going, well, what is it you don't see that you didn't take in an economics class in college or something?
Yes.
I mean, this is real simple stuff.
Yeah, you cannot borrow your way to
prosperity. I'm not a financial wizard, but I know that. No.
When you're in debt, then you are a slave to your debt. So you do not borrow yourself to liberation. You do not borrow yourself to freedom. You do not borrow yourself to opportunity. You borrow yourself into servitude.
Yeah.
It is a
well. Am I wrong in my response that I said, you know, economically, when we stop making things, all wealth is from products. I don't care whether you grow it out of the ground or whether you make it in a factory. Right. Or you dig up the steel and you sell the steel to somebody else to make something of the wood, the lumber, whatever. But it's all like products. That's your wealth. It's not money. That's just exchange. You know, so I can conduct business. We don't make anything. We took it all away.
No, in fact, you look at a company like Amazon, they're not making anything.
No,
that's
a
just
service
a service company. They have an electronic
means. They're not making the money on the product.
No, they're... it's an electronic company that just charges a fee for things that are made elsewhere, and the overwhelming percentage of them. I mean, it's almost impossible now to buy something that doesn't say made in China. I finally spent some money today on a series of products made in Israel. I was so proud to bought some a couple of carports,
keep it with homeboys,
and that sort of thing. And the products were made in Israel. It was I couldn't believe it. I was just absolutely thrilled. Here's the passage we were on at the end of the program last week that I had the epiphany and said, I really missed it. It reads, "The man called his woman's name Chawa because she was the mother of all life." And what I shared last week, I said, that's not true. Well, it's not literally of Chawa anyway, or was it? Well, Chawa was not the mother of all life, not even remotely. The meaning of her name is the elixir of life. What God has Chawa declared and made known by explaining his covenant and his Torah is the source of eternal life. Chawa does not mean life giver. Chawa means to declare and make known, and to explain and to interpret. It is from Chawa, which is written exactly the same way, to inform, and only from this context, beyond inform, you could say, well, you know, there's a first letter's the same. Che life is got a similar letter, but of the three letters that comprise Chawa, of course, only one of the three is in Che. Now, although she was the reason man would die, she, as the mother of future generations of Nesalma Adam, Nesalma man, provided the opportunity for us to live. Chawa's actionable basis is not Che life, but instead Chawa, to declare, to make known, to explain, to interpret, to announce with words, verbally or in writing. But have you ever heard that?
No.
The few people who actually know that her name was Chawa, not Eve, will say, well, Chawa means life giver. But no, it doesn't.
Oh, yeah, we've all kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it's not based on Che. It's Chawa. And one of the real problems that people have with it is that if you look up in the lexicons, there are two definitions of Chawa, primary definition and secondary definition, but they're not listed as definition one and two. They're listed as totally separate words, even though they're written exactly the same way. And the primary definition is, as I've just said, it means to inform, to explain, to announce. And somehow, I can only assume this is a derivative either of the Septuagint or the Latin Vulgate, or just religious propensity. Chawa is almost always translated to bow down and worship. But how in the hell do you get bow down and worship from a word whose meaning is to inform? And, oh, by the way, he's naming his wife Chawa. Her most recent act was to reject Yahweh's testimony because she wanted to be a god. She craved being like God, which is why she ate the fruit, why she sold the idea of eating the fruit to Adam. So you want to tell me that motivation and that act is to be equated with bowing down in worship? So how do these people that want to translate Chawa, which they do throughout all of their bibles, How in the world did they do that when the first use of the word is right here, and it obviously cannot mean that? It's so disingenuous. It's so obviously fraudulent. And every time I'll tell people, God never wants you to bow down to him, never wants to be worshipped. And they say, well, it says right there. Did you ever look at the word?
Yeah. I reinforced today. We'll get to it later with Nephilim. And then I went to the root, and then the root gave me to Palal. So then I looked at Palal again. And it's not prayer. And it is not, it's like it has nothing to do with prayer. It is all about bowing down and just went on and on and on. We'll get to it later.
Yeah.
Perhaps,
okay.
And,
so here's some fun facts about Jawa. It's Jawahe. It's based conveys to announce, as I said, to show and to proclaim. It is to interpret and explain, to tell and announce. As a noun, Jawa describes a tent settlement and an encampment. Oddly, incongruently, and as a legacy of religious malfeasance, Jawa is typically, almost universally, misrepresented in published English translations as to bow down and to prostrate oneself in worship. You cannot get there unless you're just being disingenuous. While there is no etymological basis for this interpretation, this errant representation, Jawa, which declares and makes note, shows just how effective Hasatan has been at getting religious institutions to corrupt God's testimony. In response to the first use of the word in the Torah, Yahweh makes a mockery, really, though, of this religious duplicity, because you cannot translate Jawa here as bow down and worship. And that is why his actual intent with Jawa is explained as being Che, is the source of life. So making an intelligent deduction, making an enlightened response, is in fact the source of life. That is why this statement is being made the way that it is. It is true that Yahweh's information about his covenant that is included in his Torah, when interpreted correctly and declared intelligently and responsibly, is the source of life.
Yeah, I looked up in four lexicons as you're talking. It's all declaration and declaring.
You will never, ever once, not once, see it translated that way in an English Bible.
No.
Always bow down and worship, prostrating oneself.
Wow.
Since the context directs our attention to Jawa, or Cheya, which means the feminine version of life, let it be known that it means to live and remain alive, to sustain life, to live prosperously, to be restored to life, to be revived, refreshed, and renewed. Therefore, as an amalgamation of these two concepts, Jawa's names provide the antidote for, and if I may quote the adversary's interpretation, bowing down and prostrating oneself in religious worship. Indeed, the Torah reveals that the means to Che life is Jawa, an announcement which explains Yahweh's remedy, making the proper interpretation of verbally and in writing. As such, it's a perfect depiction, truly, of the set-apart spirit's primary purpose. The set-apart purpose, set-apart spirit's purpose, is to make God's existence known. She helps us when we're reading the Torah, interpret it, and then explain the word. I would say that what we're talking about now in terms of the proper explanation of how Jawa leads to Cheya is, in fact, inspired by the Ruach Kodesh. And her inspiration, though, is not something that happens when you're eating bonbons on the sofa. I will tell you that the times that I have been inspired, you know, I've written now, well, when they're all rewritten and edited and published, it'll be about 30 books, and they average about 600 pages a piece. So, you know, that's a fair amount of material. And there's probably an average of 100 unique insights in each of them. And guess what? 99.99999% of those insights came from translating Yahweh's testimony and then thinking about what we've just read. That's how it happens. It's his word that leads to these insights. In contrast to this, if you have a strong concordance, you know, just look up H2332 in the Hebrew section. And what you're going to find is Cheya. I don't have any idea how they decided to write it as C-H-A-Y-Y-A-H. And they pronounce it Chavya. Noun proper,
yeah,
feminine.
Put the double V's in, yeah, something.
Yes, causative. I guess it's two V's. I've got a line underneath it in my computer trying to say it's a misspelling. So it's Chava with two V's, not a Y. It looked like a Y because the squiggly corrective line underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
But it does say it's two V's. It says appears two occurrences. The KJV translates as Eve twice. The first woman, wife of Adam. By the way, when was their marriage ceremony?
It was a gift.
She was a gift. Yeah. No marriage. Isha means woman. And then it says Eve equals life or living. I don't know what Eve equals, other than she was a pagan goddess. Chawa does not mean life or living. And here is strong. This is one of the things I have a problem with. We even have covenant members sometimes that will say, you know, your translation is wrong. You know, strong such and such says this.
Yeah.
You know how often strong is wrong?
A lot of times.
A lot.
A lot of times.
A lot. You know, strong's propensity is to justify the King James from which it was derived.
Yes. How they can't sell them.
Folks, if you're, I don't mind somebody saying, hey, you're wrong. Because sometimes I am. But, you know, come at it with more than this is what Strong says. Because they're wrong a lot, as is in this case. So let's consider.
Well, you know, there's another thing about Strong you have to look at, too. When a lot of times it'll be that word, and then it'll be that word A and B and C, where they break it all down like they're different words. When they're all the same, they're all the meanings of the same word, and you have to realize what the context is and to choose the appropriate one. That's what you obviously do, and JB and certainly I always try to do the same thing. So, but you can't stop there.
No, that's one of the most important aspects of translating is that we have wonderful lexicons. We have many lexicons, and I'm glad we have the lexicons, but. What you have to be really careful of is getting past the diacritical markings of the Masoretes. The Masoretes, the oldest Masoretic text, dates to about 1100. It's now called the Codex Leningradus. The Dead Sea Scrolls don't have diacritical markings. The diacritical markings, they are alleged to have first appeared around 100, 200 CE, there's no extant proof of that. The first proof in a manuscript is the Codex Leningradus at about 1100 CE. And so, if you want to translate, one of the first things you have to do is recognize that the Masoretes were religious charlatans. They lived around the time of Maimonides. They were conmen. I mean, Maimonides didn't get anything right. It's kind of like Akiva, making the father of your religion, the person who promoted a false messiah that got you kicked out of the land, got the land renamed, and got a couple hundred thousand of you crucified. And that's my guy, man.
Yeah.
And stupid. Well, you know, Maimonides converted to Islam. He was the vicar of Saladin.
Saladin, worked for Saladin. Yeah,
he his whole 13 principles of Judaism, he didn't get any of them right. I mean, he was a dunderhead, and these guys worship these idiots. So that's the time of the Masoretes. Masoretes are just flat out wrong on their vocalization most of the time. And it's not that hard, because all you have to do is look at the Hebrew letters and say, what other words are there that are formed with these same letters? Because the Hebrew text only has the letters. It doesn't have the diacritical markings. And therefore, you have to look at every possible, reasonable definition with the same letters and apply the ones that fit. It's not that hard to do, but that's the first thing you have to do. Even more important than getting back to the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is valuable because one word in 14 is was changed over time. Yes. And one word in 14, it's important. But far more than one word in 14 has been changed by diacritical markings. And you can resolve that just by taking them out of the equation. For example, there is no chaba. There's no B in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. So let's consider these arrows, each of them one at a time. First, the Hebrew letters C-H-W-H. That's how the word is spelled. It's a three-letter root that's very common in Hebrew. There isn't one B, much less two. In fact, there are no Bs among the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. One of the things that Strong's also does that is really stupid is that they have a lot of words transliterated with a C. Now, there is a CH in the J, but there's no
salt. You don't need it with two S's. Why
right.
You need
so, there, yeah, there's no standalone C. It is a there are actually three S's in Hebrew, two standard S's and an SH. So Shemek, Sin, and Shin. Mm-hmm. So there is no standalone C. A second. Shawa is a proper noun. Not just a noun. It's a proper noun. The difference is a proper noun is a name. He said he called her name. Name. Proper noun. As the universal rules for names is that all names need to be transliterated. They need to replicate the sound in the other language. And so Chawa is Chawa is Chawa. No matter if you're speaking French,
Chinese,
or you're speaking Ruski, or you're speaking Tanya, it's always Chawa. Period.
Or Sylvan.
End of conversation. If you want to be better informed and understand why Yahweh chose the name Chawa, then you can define it, but the definition isn't the name. It's the reason for the name. There is no possible way to get Eve from C-H-W-H. Okay, can you tell me how you transliterate Eve from C-H-W-H? Eve is three different letters, two E's, and give me a V, please. I'm sorry. There is no E. There is no V.
No, there's no V.
No E. Yeah. There is a CH. There is a W. There is a A. But since Roman Catholicism grew by incorporating pagan customs, of the people they conquered, Chawa was renamed Eve. Why? Because the Greeks, the Romans, they had a goddess named Eve. She was. She's from Heba. You'll find her written in Catholicism's Latin Vulgate after the popular pagan Mother Earth goddess. She is the name, the same false spirit our planet derived its name from. You know, it's the reason that Iesu Christu became so popular with Greeks and Romans is he was modeled after the single most popular individual and the history of Greece and Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Odysseus.
Very nice.
Okay, now, was Odysseus a real person? No. Make believe. But it's a great story about him, and he is imbued with all of the great Greek
hero myths. And he's out there fighting the gods, and he is the ideal Greek. And, of course, the Romans swallowed and became all things Greek. He was the perfect person to model him after. And the god that was most similar to Odysseus was, of course, Dionysus. You take the two, and you have the Christian Jesus. Now, third, there is no indication that Chawa was the first human woman. In fact, the likelihood of her being the first human woman is nil. She was the first female created in the likeness of man who was based, who had an Asama conscience, who was therefore in the image of God. God's testimony and the scientific evidence confirm that human animals populated the planet outside of the garden for a better part of 200,000 or 300,000 years.
Yes.
And the Torah talks expressly about them.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth, Eve does not mean or equate to life or living, but according to the religious, which evolved from Babylon, Mother Earth was the life giver. She was impregnated by the sun during the spring equinox, and she gave birth to the son of the sun 9 months later during the winter solstice. Sound familiar? As such, mm-hmm. She was called Mother of God and the Queen of Heaven. Today, these pagan rites are known as Easter and Christmas.
Yes.
Yep. Now, fifth, Chawa is not causally from H2331. They are actually indistinguishable. As Chawa from Strong's H2333 is written identically. And as we know, the first Chawa, Strong's H2331, means to tell, to declare, to show, to explain,
declare,
to
people, show.
And to know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, in turn, it is based on H2324. Now, Strong's 2421, Chaya, meaning to live, to remain alive, to sustain life, is the word that God says this announcement will lead to Chaya, life, but that's not the basis of the word. Also, Chaya, as Strong's 2333, is a shelter and tent encampment. That's what it is actually as a noun. As such, it is synonymous with sukkah, camping out. A great deal is lost when man copy edits Yahweh's word, replacing his names and words with those that do not belong. Isn't that what got Chawa into this mess in the first place?
It's the twist.
Did they miss the intent of that story? If you do that, you're going to die, God said. They did it, and they're still doing it. And they know
it's wrong.
Yet you won't find Chawa's name in any English Bible. And so Adam called his wife's name Chawa, one who makes known, because she exists as the mother of all life. Yahweh's Ruach Kodesh, set apart spirit, as our spiritual mother, is the source of eternal life in the covenant, and by adorning us in a garment of light, she makes this happen. All right. And Yahweh Almighty acted and engaged, creating for Adam to approach and his woman to draw near garments of hide, clothing and dressing them in white. Labash, which means adorning and covering them from Laban to be purified in white. That's the last statement of the third chapter of Bereshit 3:21. Adam and Chawa had made their own clothes. Remember? Fig leaves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Fig leaves.
But they still felt naked, even though they had been naked before and didn't feel naked. Now with fig leaves, they feel naked and exposed in Yahweh's presence. The fact is that man cannot attire himself satisfactory, no matter how good he is or how hard he tries. Yeah, to enter God's presence. Only God is capable of adorning us appropriately so that we can appear before him. Therefore, Yahweh acted and engaged, doing what was necessary to fashion the first family's garments. They were adorned in the set-apart spirit's garment of light, Laban. This announcement was instructive and also symbolic. Since Adam and Chawa were now estranged and dying, a solution was required. And that's why we were told that this garment not only came from an animal, the life of that animal was sacrificed for them to be adorned in it. This metaphorical representation of life is depicted in Passover with the sacrifice of a perfect lamb. So, Kirk, that brings us to I guess we still have a few more. I made a mistake here. We still have a little more meat on the bone here in Bereshit 3, but we're heading very quickly to 4, where we're going to learn a lot about Chawa in particular. So as we turn the page, it's 3968 BCE on our calendars. It's year zero on Yah's timepiece. And we read, "Then Yahweh, who is God, said, 'This man,'" I said, "behold, this man, Adam, has become similar. He's become one of us with regard to becoming aware of good and bad." Yeah, he had access to both the good and bad, where previously he only had access to good. So they're acknowledging a statement of fact and we have to be really careful here. There's this tendency to think that, oh, wow, you know, God's worried that man is going to be bigger, better, smarter than him. No.
It's how he can handle the information.
It's only one aspect of man that has become similar to God. God obviously knew both good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
Understood it. He actually created bad so there would be a choice for us to make. And so the only thing that has changed is that man has gained the knowledge of bad, that which is counterproductive and evil and inappropriate and unjust, immoral, and the like. And that's all that God said. So now, lest he stretch out his hand and also grasp hold and obtain from the tree of life and eat, living forever, Yahweh Almighty sent him out from the protection of the Garden of Eden to work,
you know,
and in which place to, for the benefit of the relationship he was taking. Go ahead, Kirk.
Well, I was just going to say that always struck me as an odd thing to do until I read Yada Yada the first time, and you revealed when it's quite obvious that if you have Passover and you don't celebrate Matzah, then you go. You have nowhere to go but to be away from God, and there's only one place away from God, and that's Sheol.
And all of a sudden, this is it.
I mean, this is.
It is. It's beautiful because the implication that the religious would say is that God punished Adam to keep Adam from being a rival to God. No, he loved Adam. He's protecting Adam because the worst thing you could have is what Christianity has. You're acknowledging Passover, though you don't really call it Passover, but you're acknowledging something really important happened on Passover. There was a sacrifice on Passover, and you skip right
and
over
you forgot matzah. Yeah.
And if you are eternal, if you eat of the tree of lives and you become eternal, but you're still got this problem of bad resonating in you because you ate of the tree without any remedy at this point, well, you're going to be eternal.
You do,
and therefore, but imperfect,
separated.
Therefore separated from God, and eternal separated from God means you get an express ticket to Sheol. The last thing that Yahweh wanted, you know,
it's horrible.
One thing he didn't want to have to put him out of Eden, and the last thing he wanted to go is from Eden into Sheol because there's no return. And so God was doing him a favor. He wasn't trying to harm him. This was not a penalty. And a lot of that, too, is this idea that work is somehow a bad thing. No, work is a good thing.
They sent them out to work. Boy, yep. We have about half the U.S. population. That would be a good thing, too. Send them out to work.
Right.
In fact, if
they shut everything down,
the blue state governors, more people might be able to go out and work.
Hmm.
But the issue here is that they had become imperfect. They were going to die as a result unless that was resolved. And while God has provided symbolically the means for life and Passover, he does not want them to eat of the tree of lives and become immortal before they have resolved this problem. Now,
mm-hmm.
One aspect of becoming Ka, similar to God, is Yada, knowing more than the first couple knew then or that we know now. Yeah, newsflash, Yahweh's a lot smarter than we are. He's been around, well, I've been around over 50 years, and I would tell you that Yahweh has got me beat by, well, far beyond 14 billion of the of universal creation, because he goes way beyond that. And even if we just take the 14 billion compared to over 50,
mm-hmm.
there's no comparison.
Gotcha.
And he has experienced it all and seen it all and knows it all. Oh, well, I don't know. That's with the, but he's seen everything he wishes to see.
Yeah.
And
he knows how it all works.
Yeah. He revealed this testimony and we're just trying to understand it. But we're not in the same class here. Not in the same zip code, not in the same hemisphere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we need to understand that. And then there's a lot more than Yada differentiating us from God. For example, now I've invested 50,000 hours translating and contemplating Yahweh's testimony. And after devouring all I could find from the tree of knowledge, if you will, I can assure you that I am as similar to God as a leaf is from the largest forest on earth. And that's probably too generous.
Small leaf.
Therefore, let's not get carried away with ourselves.
I know.
Yeah, that God is worried that little old Adam was somehow going to become a rival. Instead, he was concerned about Adam's well-being. Yep, by having become aware of Ra, that which was counterproductive and disagreeable, invalid, disappointing, ugly, and saddening, devaluing and distressful, as if he had read Paul's letters, Adam needed Yahweh's compassion and support so that he did not become an eternal resident of Sheol.
Wow.
Elohim, in this particular state, was used to represent a singular entity held in the highest esteem. It is called the royal we in ancient literature. However, sometimes, as may be the case here, Elohim, which is the plural of El, meaning Almighty God, is actually intended to be plural. Here, followed by Ananu, and in concert with the work of the set-apart spirit, Elohim and Ananu may be addressing our Heavenly Father and Spiritual Mother collectively striving to help Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond this possibility, we may refer to the heavenly host of spiritual beings that were also
in the Malak.
Presence at this point, but I think less than the set-apart spirit. Now, and the set-apart spirit has an independent capability.
Role,
yeah, she was mm-hmm. she's introduced in the second day of creation. She plays a huge role in God's relationship with humankind. Now, should you be wondering why Yahweh would have been concerned about Adam becoming immortal, as we've talked about, Adam was now corrupted, and having become immortal in this condition would have essentially put him in Sheol with Hasatan, the adversary who had beguiled. them. It's the place of eternal separation. God intended Adam to return to fellowship, and that would have precluded it if immortality occurred without first unleavening his soul of sin. This is akin to the Christian debacle of Easter, in which they observe a twisted variation of Passover on Good Friday. Good Friday, where they have their dead God on a stick, tortured by the Romans, and then they just skip right over on yeast and bread. Thus, having become immortal but not perfected, they are destined for the lightless prison known as Sheol, the worst possible outcome, and it explains Satan's inspiration in the Christian religion. Misery loves company. Now, Yahweh knew that uprooting the tree of lives would preclude the future resolution for any man or woman. And he realized by his actions that Adam could no longer be trusted to do as he had been instructed. So the only responsible solution was to protect Adam from this tree by excluding him from the garden and then precluding future access. Now, and again, God provided everything for them and perfect access to him in a perfect environment. No death, no religion, no politics, no government of any kind, no judicial system, no police, no confusion. Meet with God whenever you want. You're the beautiful couple enjoying the perfect environment. Well, they chose not that. And so they had to experience not that. If they could choose not that and nothing changed, then what's the fuss over choice?
That's true.
So things had to change for them. Adam's and Chawa's expulsion from the Garden of Eden was neither overbearing nor inappropriate. Had God not done this, he would have become dishonest. If God said, hey, yeah, okay, I told you that if you ate from this this one tree here, that you would begin to manifest what it means to die. And then say, it's just kidding. You can do it. We'll do it your way, not my way. Then why would you trust anything he says? If man or Satan is free to modify, change God's testimony, then why even bother to know it? Could not God become anything you wanted him to be?
Mm-hmm. That's what they do.
That's what they do. It bears repeating then. Adam had unabridged, unfettered access to all that was good. All he gained in this deal with the devil was an awareness of evil, of that which was errant and counterproductive. But now, as a direct result of choosing to reject Yah's directions and his generosity, his company, Adam would suffer the consequence. It is the same choice we must all make. Do we want to rely on God and enjoy his company, or do we want to do it on our own? To rely on man is to die sooner or later. To rely on God is to live forever. But we cannot pursue both options, which is the point of exclusion. Adam and Chawa would be cast out into the rest of humanity. Based upon what we are told later in the Torah, Adam would ultimately be restored in his relationship with Yahweh. But not on this day. He was banished from the garden and thus into a hostile world replete with suffering, anguish, fear, pain, even death. I, by the way, do not know the fate of Chawa as we go forward. Chawa does some really, really rotten thing. But, you know, God has accommodation for those that do rotten things. Look at Abraham, the pauper. The Pooperini was over there in Iraq talking about the Abrahamic religions. I wanted to go to Ur, the birthplace. So he went to all these pagan temples at Ur and celebrating the birth of his religion. But it was really true, but not in the way that he recognized it, of course. And these Nimrods have no concept as to who Abraham was. I mean, just none. But anyway, if God could overlook the issues with Abraham, he, I'm sure, could overlook the issues with Chawan. It may have turned out just fine for her. She's, other than to understand what we're told about her and what it means to us and the frustration God must have endured, is neither Adam nor Chawa are high on my list of people I want to meet in eternity. You know, I've got my, my, you know, first person I want to meet is, but so does everybody else, is Go. Yeah, and I'm really partial to Yashiyah.
Yashiyah?
And Eliyah is the funniest dude in the world.
Well,
so, you know,
you
getting some Eliyah. Yeah, I just have a glass of wine. Yeah, he's just the coolest dude in the world. And, you know, and to be a Noah in the middle of his time and have the fortitude to build a ship, you know, I'd like to meet him. And somehow I'm just interested in what in the world poor Sarah endured to make all this work. There's people too, like Deborah. I think she'd be really interesting. Ruth, oh my goodness, what an interesting character she must have been. I think Samuel has got is a really an interesting character. So there's a lot of people that I would enjoy meeting that we are introduced to along the way, but Adam and Chawa are really not high on the
falling down the
no.
list.
Because, you know, we're going to know exactly what life was like for them in the garden. We're going to know it firsthand.
Oh,
it's not going to
happen.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yep. These troubling conditions that existed outside of the garden had been that way all along. The reason that Eden had walls and armed guards was to keep the mayhem at bay. That's Yahweh's idea of Yasha, the word that's translated salvation. It actually means to liberate and to protect, to keep from harm's way. And the walls of Eden weren't there to keep Adam and Chawa prisoners. No, they were to keep all of the mayhem outside of the garden from affecting them. It's God's idea of separation from that which
is like
bad.
It's a sheep. It's a sheep with a thorn.
Yeah.
Thorn.
Yeah, exactly.
It.
Yeah, the
concept.
It's
yeah.
not to keep them prisoners. It's to keep wolves from coming in.
Keep the
eating.
Wolves around. Yeah.
Yeah. So the fact is that we aren't told how long Adam and Chawa and Yahweh camped out together before the fall. And really, the fall of man is something that took place outside of the garden, not inside the garden. And while it could have been a million years, although I suspect 70, based upon Adam representing the first millennia of human history and of his life lasting 930 years post exile. And one of the things about that, too, that I sort of like is that God says, you know, in a day you're going to die. The day that you eat of it, you're going to die. Well, a day
is
God
a thousand
is,
years.
Was emphasized
yeah,
is a thousand years, and therefore it would be a nice fit for that. But we aren't told. It doesn't really matter.
No.
It's just kind of a
no.
curiosity. So Adam had been incorruptible and thus immortal. It's sort of like light, you know. That's one of the things that scientists really can't get through their noggins. They want to be impressive and pretend like they know. And, you know, they'll say that the universe is 13.7 billion years old. Of course, last year it was 13.4 billion years old, and the year before that, 15 billion years old. But anyway, they want to be precise, and they say, and then that was the Big Bang, that was the creation of the universe. No. That was the moment quarks cooled to the point we had quark confinement, and then energy became matter, because prior to energy becoming matter, time simply was, it didn't flow. So Adam, as an immortal being, time would not have moved like we sense it. It was pre-time in that cocoon, if you will, of Eden. So that's one of the things that we don't have a great appreciation of. But like a photon of light, on a photon of light, time simply exists. All time exists on a photon of light. So, the advantage is on a photon of light, you could go from one side to the other side of the universe. I guess they say that's like 96 billion light years, and you could do it in no time because time doesn't flow the way we understand time flowing, and so speed is now irrelevant. So that's kind of the idea as to how you can move, maneuver through the entire universe, is that even though speed is limited to the speed of light, on that photon of light, time simply is, and so there's no denominator when trying to ascertain speed, which is distance over time, because time is essentially exists. So the same thing would have been true here. The same thing would be true with the Big Bang. We don't know how much time elapsed before quark confinement. All we know is how much time has elapsed since quark confinement, which, by the way, is probably this 13.7-ish billion years with from the perspective of Earth looking back at 624-hour days based upon being at creation, based upon the cosmic gradient radiation background.
Background
there,
shield.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Tree of Lives is interesting, too, because it is giant, always plural. Now, it's always plural. The Tree of Lives is plural because, well, I'm going to give my 2 cents anyway, my 2 shekels here, is because we are afforded the opportunity of a second life should we choose wisely regarding that tree. Yeah. So that's why I think it's called the Tree of Lives. There is a life among men of varying lengths, and then for the fortunate few who avail themselves of the covenant, there is another with God, the Tree of Lives. This is now the fourth time that Yahweh has mentioned work. We've made a big deal of it in the past. It is clearly something he views as being more appropriate than does any American politician. And that is to say that God has never offered men charity. There are no divine entitlements. None. God does not have a welfare system. Even in the charity that existed, you, for example, would leave the corners of your field unharvested. So if somebody was hungry, they would have access. They had to harvest it. Then they had to process that food, prepare it, cook it, carry it where they were. There was firewood in the storehouse to make a fire for cooking. There was wool in the storehouse for making clothing, but you had to make it. And so if you were down and out on your luck, you know, things were going poorly, you had the opportunity to work to better your situation and that of your family. But God realizes if you give somebody for nothing, if salvation is a free gift of God and not a result of works, then you destroy character and you destroy the value of the relationship. What fun would it be to be in a relationship with somebody who can provide nothing in return?
No joke.
It's miserable.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're in a relationship and one person's doing all the work, they're providing all the conversation, all of the insights, all of the revenue, all of the food, all of everything, that's not a relationship. You've got a source of life and a parasite.
Yeah, that's
not how the covenant is designed. The covenant is a family. And in a family, yes, the father and mother give more, and they have different roles, than the children do. But if the children don't spend time with mom and dad, don't try to grow and learn and experience the joys of life with mom and dad, if the children say, no, instead, I want you to provide me with drugs, and I want you to provide me with alcohol, and I want you to provide me with video games. I want you to provide me everything that I can just check out. You provide me room and shelter and food and money, and I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to do anything with you. That family is cancerous. And so God's not into free gifts. Salvation is not free. There are five things God expects of us, and none of them come without effort. Now, I will tell you that all five things that he expects of us, not one of them is money. Not one of them is prayer. Not one of them is worship. Not one of them is repentance. Not one is faith. Not one is religion. Not one is being good. None of those. But there are five things he expects of us. We have to disassociate ourselves from human, religious, and political and cultural schemes. I'll tell you something. That takes work. Gosh, Kirk, we've been at it for 20 years. We're still working
at it.
Yes,
we are. Well, yeah.
So that's the first. It happens to be a tremendous gift. It's so uplifting and liberating once you do it. The second is that God asks us to walk to him and become perfect. He's the one that is perfecting us through matzah, but we have to make the effort to answer his invitations and attend his moment, to receive the benefit. You don't receive the benefit by being oblivious. You don't receive the benefit by ignoring him. You have to participate in these invitations. And then, God is quite clear, and he says, I want you to trust and rely on me.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't trust somebody you don't know. You can't rely on something you don't understand. And knowing and understanding takes a lot of effort.
Yep.
If you're not willing to put in the effort, good riddance, you would hate eternity anyway. God likes effort. He likes work. He's constantly telling us that he wants us to work because we build character. Toad was a real worker. He was always engaged. He got up early, prepared himself, and on top of herding cats, and probably the toughest kingdom on earth to manage and to defend, he's writing the most beautiful songs that have ever been written. And not a few of them, but 100 of them. So God likes it when we work. We're better off working. Charity destroys a person's character. And so there are things that we must do. In fact, like the fourth condition of the covenant is to closely examine and carefully consider the instructive conditions of that covenant.
Yeah.
He expelled, therefore, Adam. Wa garash. He banished, cast out, removing, such that Eden would be unoccupied and thus estranged. And then he established living karubama to the east of the approach to the Garden of Eden with blazing swords, who went back and forth to keep watch on the way of the Tree of Lives. Now, there had been some, we don't know if it was just two, but there had been some humans allowed into the garden because Yahweh introduced Adam to all of the animals in the open environment. And people were part of those animals. So there had been humans in the garden. And so God is making sure that Adam and Chawa don't sneak back in, but that he knows he really can't trust them, but that other humans don't sneak in either. We have a propensity to be bad with short lifespans. Can you imagine how bad we would be if we lived for
1,000 years?
Oh, my goodness.
We destroy everything.
So, one of the things that happens on the in chapter 6 of Bereshit is God says 120 years is it. That's the absolute maximum. So this longer period of time, no, we're not going to do that anymore. Man does not handle that very well. I'm retranslating now Bereshit 6 for the second to last chapter of volume 4 of Questioning Paul. Mm-hmm. And it is amazing how religious and political the phylum were. So we should be pleased to find Gerash expected, described in the peel stem and the perfect conjugation. It means that Adam, and thus mankind, would suffer the effect for a limited period of time. Okay, yeah, now we're talking about 6,000 years. You might say, well, that's a long... Well, it's written in the perfect. That means the time is limited as it relates to being expelled. We're about ready to be let back in.
Yeah.
We're going to be allowed back in. As we move through the Torah, the cherubim, called cherubim, which is the plural of cherub, cherub is actually a masculine noun. You know, typically the cherubim for decor or pretty little girls are kind of childish with, you know, porky cheeks and that sort of thing. I kind of wonder why they, but they're carrying swords, so folks, they're not little chunky.
Flaming swords and winged are not people that are.
Come on.
Come on.
And they were there to keep people away from the Tree of Lives. Now, you don't have to be there anymore to keep people away from the Tree of Lives, because the Tree of Lives is probably underneath the Lake Van in eastern Turkey, which is where all this stuff transpired. But the same cherubim were depicted on both sides of the reconciliation seat of the Ark of the Covenant. That story is told in Shemot, Names 25, in relation to receiving the and storing Yahweh's testimony and meeting with him. They are mentioned again in conjunction with the 10 drapes that were hung within the tabernacle, where the images were woven into the cloth. So, they must have been present at some point during the Exodus, because Yahweh, who is meticulous in his depictions of the Ark, the menorah, and the tabernacle, said absolutely nothing about their appearance, other than he lives and speaks among them. There are seven references to Yahweh appearing between two cherubim, the first being the most revealing, in Bamidbar Numbers 7:89. It reads, "Then Moshe went to the tent of the meeting to speak with him. He heard the voice speaking to him above the reconciliation seat that was upon the Ark of the Testimony between the two cherubim."
Now, don't you think those are the two that also were there when he went to see Abraham, talking about Lot? The two?
It certainly
don't they have to be. That's why it's two of them.
Yeah, it certainly could be. You know, there's so many other options for the two that were there, but it is certainly possible. Yeah. We just aren't told why there would be multiples. It is interesting that Yahweh really does not do anything alone.
Arbitrarily, yeah.
Right, arbitrarily. So, he's establishing a pattern that Yahweh will follow throughout time. But clearly, Moshe saw what they looked like when they were to be put on the Ark of the Covenant. He would be able to describe
created.
Them. But so they, the earliest the Israelites that were tasked with making the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant had seen them. Otherwise, they would not have been able to carve their shape. So we can reliably deduce that the cherubim are directly associated with Yahweh's presence among us, with his testimony to us, and with our reconciliation. As such, it is not their appearance which matters, but instead what they convey about Yahweh's intent. And here, on the eastern side of the garden, they are instructed to shamar, to closely examine and to carefully consider at the derech, that which pertains to the path or the way of the Tree of Lives. That is good advice for us because it turns our attention to the Moed Mikre, the invitations to meet, be called out by God, to be welcomed into his presence, because they would serve as light along that path. Mikre is a walkway. It's six steps that lead to the final destination. That final destination is essentially camping out with God in Eden.
Yeah, and, yeah.
Since there seems to be a connection between cherubim and Korah, which is feast, written identically but pronounced Kara, it describes a pasture, a dwelling, and a shelter. In a verbal form, Kara ties things together for us so that we understand these connections. Therefore, as a verb, Kara describes the preparation for a feast. This is used in the Devarim 2:6, Job 6:27, and 40:30, in addition to Hosea 3:2, to depict an exchange where one thing is traded for another. This is the concept behind both Pesach and Matzah. In this regard, it is used in Mizmor 22 when we learn that Yosha will be pierced, his life exchanged for ours. Not surprisingly, a car is a male lamb. So, yeah, this is a word that we're supposed to think our way through to understand who these two male guards are at Eden. Because we clearly pass right by them on the way to life. So God didn't say, I want you to kill everybody that comes by here or to stop them. No, because we pass right by them. They are lights along the way, but it is a narrow, straight path, and you can't weave off of it and get to God. So, you know, they're gatekeepers in a way. They're guides in a way.
They're symbols.
Yeah, they're symbols in a way. Now, considering what Yahweh has just revealed about clothing, there are also there's also a connection between Karubim and Karbal, which is to be adorned in a garment. Karotz means herald, suggesting that the Karubim have something in common with the Malach messengers, a spiritual implements, and those are the spiritual implements, of course, who serve as God's envoys. We also know that, like the Malach, they follow orders and thus they exist in a similar command and control structure that is devoid of free will. A Malach is not, and a Karubim are most likely Malach. They are not going to care one iota that God says, I want you to stay on the east side of this wall and guard it. For them, that is not a boring job. The Malach who's mission it was to guard the Ark of the Covenant and the Ten Tablets so that Yahweh can lift them in the middle of the time of Jacob's trouble. Those Malach are not the least bit troubled that, you know, I've been there for a couple of thousand years and this is getting old.
Damn.
No. You know, they have the honor of working for the creator of the universe. They know him personally. Their mission is to be effective implements for what he wants done. They get to live forever in God's presence. And for them, time is just as it is for God. If God wants to enjoy a second over 1,000 years, he can. if something is so wonderful that that just moment in time is so enjoyable to him that he wants to experience every nuance over of that second over 1,000 years, he can. If God wants, you know, from the fall of man to back to restoration in the garden, if Yahweh's view of that is, okay, this is really getting old. I'll intervene when I need to. But otherwise, let's just fast forward to the good part. He can. 6,000 years could be like 6 seconds. So the beauty of being an energy-based being is that time does not, you're not stuck in the flow of time, is the way I like to say it. You're no longer stuck in the flow of time. You're liberated in time. To expand the moment or to contract
it
a longer period. And it's what gives you not only eternal life, but the ability to travel throughout the universe and go wherever you want to go. And then because energy and matter are the same thing, just different amounts of the same thing, when you get to a place that you say, boy, wouldn't it be nice to enjoy a good meal, a glass of wine, I feel this particular sun, a warming a body, the feet in the stream, smelling the wet dew on the grass, you know, all of these kinds of things. Hearing the rustling of leaves in the wind. When you want to go there and enjoy life at a different pace, you'll be able to transition back to matter. And then when you say, okay, that was great, but now I want to go over here or do this, or I want to check in and see what God's doing, and you turn back into energy and you can go up to the seventh dimension.
You never run out of energy.
No, it's just that it's a marvelous
deal.
Combination of opportunities. So that the ultimate message here is that Yahweh has purposely kept mankind from stumbling into the garden and entering it without first closely examining and carefully considering the path associated with the Tree of Lives. But you will not find it under Lake Van in modern-day Turkey, so there is no reason to look for it there. The Tree of Lives is rooted in Yahweh's word. It branches out through Dod to Yosha. Today we find its essence within Pesach Passover, which is the doorway to life. And that may be a good place, Kirk, for us to. I know you did your a lot of your homework on beginning on Bereshith 4:1, and that is our next passage. So we'll start there next week. And we, for those who are in the continental United States, with the exception of Arizona, it's daylight savings time. So the show will start the same time for you, but it will be an hour earlier. Here in Paradise, we don't change our silly clocks. So for me, it starts an hour earlier than it would otherwise. So looking forward to being with you with our first program on the other side of daylight savings. May Yah bless and have a wonderful Shabbat to one and all.
Good.
Goodbye.
Good night, buddy.
Good night.